Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 15th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Isaac and Ishmael, Session 2 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Michael and Susan Thomas, number THM 2003-02. Let's listen in.
We welcome you tonight to this second set of second session in the set of seminars that Michael and I are working with here at Holden this week. And I want to just make sure that everybody has gotten a Bible or you have access to seeing a Bible as you came in. And would you please, if anyone else comes in after you, remind them to get one so that you can have it for reference. This session is called Isaac and Ishmael, and we will be looking a bit at the biblical texts about Isaac and Ishmael and their mothers, Sarah and Hagar, and their father, Abraham. And we'll also be looking at how the children of Abraham today have found the promises given to Abraham to be salvific and problematic. As a beginning, I would just like you to keep in mind that the stories that we hear from the Bible about Hagar and Ishmael, and also about Sarah and Isaac, are stories of God not forgetting or abandoning those who are cast out or those who are barren, and that God intervenes to save. So those two things I would like to try to keep before us, the not forgetting or abandoning the cast out, and God's intervention to save. We've come in with this wonderful icon, which perhaps some of you are familiar with. It's a Russian icon by Rublev, Andrei Rublev. And it takes the theme of the three visitors to Abraham from Genesis 18. When the three visitors came to visit Abraham and Sarah and announced to them that Sarah finally was indeed going to conceive and in her old age. And remember the wonderful part about how Sarah laughed and how this was such unbelievable news at that point in their lives, where they had been waiting and waiting and waiting for fulfillment of the promises that God had been making along the way to Abraham to be the father of many nations and to receive the promise of land. And because this is an interesting icon in that it only features the three visitors, and they have this icon in other versions, may often have Abraham and Sarah and a little building over in the corner and a more complete scene. But Rublev's icon, interestingly enough, for Christians has become, do you know what this icon is called in the Christian? It's the Trinity icon. So the idea being that these three visitors to Abraham were a sign of the Trinity. Very interesting when you think of Abraham and monotheism, that one would take this scene as a hint toward God as being triune as well as one. So that's an interesting thing that happens in this. So this is up here And I wanted us to have that before us as we think about the familiar story of Abraham and the promise of Isaac, and how this is a story that for many of us is well known. And Isaac has the sort of priority in that. So we know the story of this branch of Abraham's family, the branch through Isaac. And in fact, we indeed as Christians claim that we have been made also heirs of this family line in our baptism into Christ and become also children of Abraham. So we actually even feel that we participate in that line. And in a sense, we know, maybe not as quite as well as we should, but we do know the story of the suffering of Isaac's descendants, that is, the Jews. We have been, I think, in the last 20 to 30 years, or should have been, well educated on what has happened in these centuries to the Jews, and particularly in the 20th century and the terrible sin of the Holocaust and the genocide of Jewish people in Europe. I know that for myself, one of the things that was the most, probably my first understanding of a great wrong in the world was when I was in about third grade and I heard for the first time about what had happened to the Jews during the World War, and how much I identified with that story, and would even, you know, was fantasizing about maybe some of my relatives in Germany were Jewish and pretended to become Christian, or maybe whatever, you know, that it was really a sense that this maybe was my story as well. And being very aware, even, I'm not sure about at that time, but later on, about the story of people, the Jewish people coming back to Israel and forming Israel and the homeland there. And I remember as a teenager pounding out the theme to the movie Exodus. And this land is mine, God made this land for me. You know, gave this land to me. It's not made this land, but gave this land to me. That whole thing. And unquestioning about it. And so I don't think for most of us American Christians that it's a very big leap as we trace our history through that familiar line of Abraham, Isaac, Jesus, us, that we can rather easily begin to understand the longing for the homeland and the return of the Jews there, where after the terrible tragedy of the Holocaust, they might again grow as a people and thrive. And so when this land became a state in 1948, it made a lot of sense to much of the world. It was not that simple, but just for right now, we're going to treat it that simple. A dispersed people coming home to this land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants, and there they are, the descendants coming. So I would like us now, though, to look at a segment of a news program done by a reporter that we got to know in Jerusalem, who works for Sky News, a British television agency. And in this, he's done a series around the roadmap, trying to help people understand that. This segment is the first segment in a series of about six that he did in early May. And this one deals with Israeli settlers who have come to settle in the West Bank, which is Palestinian area, and how committed they are to the claiming of this land for Jews. We might turn out the lights a little bit. Can you see there? Mm-hmm. Is this in your way?
Yeah, it's good.
It's required, but it'll take careful navigation, and that needs people with fistfuls of hope. We took a week to travel up and down this land to meet some of those people and investigate some of those issues. We'd like to think we walked a little way on the road to peace, but that's the longest shot of all. Our first visit was to the settlers.
Well, Jewish settlements on the West Bank and in Gaza are one of the thorniest issues on the roadmap to peace in the Middle East. The first of a series of reports, we look at the settlements, communities which house more than 200,000 Israelis and have been the cause of Arab anger and resentment since Israelis captured of the territories in Jordan and Egypt in the 1967 war. It's on the West Bank that settlement activity has been most prolific, with hundreds of communities being built up by Jews who moved there for ideological and economic reasons. Those are the areas shown in red. Now, as if the established settlements weren't contentious enough, since the Oslo peace talks, settlers have been expanding, establishing new outposts on which to build more settlements over the areas here in blue. They're not officially recognised by the Israeli government, and some have been dismantled, but new outposts are springing up all the time. Well, Guy Andrew Wilson is at a more established settlement in Shiloh. He joins us there live now.
Well, you find us here in what would at first sight appear to be a benign suburban environment with well-to-do housing, neighbours from Brooklyn, New York, from Memphis, Tennessee, from Paris in France and from London, all building what seems to be a happy commuter community. Except there's a catch. The catch is we're not in any kind of commuting Israeli town. We're in the heart of the West Bank. We're in the heart of the land that the Palestinians believe and are determined will one day make up their state. And if we're talking about a road to peace, as far as much of the international community is concerned, and certainly the Palestinians, these settlements, this one now 25 years old, make up the greatest obstacle to that road. Our first feature story this week starts here in Shiloh. Settlements have always been the bane of every Middle East peace negotiator. Israelis living on land captured from Jordan in 1967, land that the Palestinians want for their future state. A position that up and down the West Bank and Gaza often puts them at violent odds with their Palestinian neighbors. But while the negotiators struggle even to talk, the building of houses and roads continues. The settlements, as far as the settlers are concerned, are the future, not the past.
The fact that they cannot sing freely a Palestinian national anthem or fly the flag or have for their own passports, I understand that. But not every single small group of people deserves a state. I'm sorry to tell the Palestinian Arabs, in my opinion, that they're not going to be the 23rd independent sovereign Arab state.
David and Lisa Rubin moved to Shiloh 12 years ago. David's been shot once by Palestinian gunmen, as has his little boy Ruby, in the neck, in the back of their car. He nearly died. But this is their spiritual home, and they're going nowhere.
When someone is shooting to kill my son, or to kill me, and their intent is to make us leave here, we're not leaving. That's my reaction. It makes us more determined to stay, more determined that what we're doing is right.
The roadmap tackles the settlement issue on two levels, facts on the ground and expansion. Expansion can mean towns turning into cities, like Opera behind us in the valley there, or hilltop sites, fresh caravans on new ground, so-called outposts. For example, this is Shibut Rachel. The caravans below are where it started. The red roofs, the expanded town. and above the new site. That's 5 years' work. This was Shukuk Rahel in 1998. Even under Israeli law, these new hilltop sites are illegal, but no Israeli prime minister has ever challenged them. There are now 106, 63 established since the start of the Intifada. The residents are tough and determined.
The Palestinian people, and not only the Palestinian people, but unfortunately, our neighbors in all the neighboring countries, are not open to coexistence. They want us in one place and one place only, and that's back over there in the sea, Mediterranean, back in Europe. But they fail to realize that Israel and the Israeli people are here to stay.
In 1998, the last time peace negotiations threatened the settlements, Ariel Sharon, then foreign minister, famously told the settlers to go and seize the hilltops. In 1999, he told international diplomats that settlements contributed to peace. It's a stance well remembered, and it's unlikely that the Americans or the roadmap will have any new suggestions to make him change his position or his mind.
We moved about 10 miles south from Shiloh, where we were before. The dilapidated caravans give you an idea of how this all started about 5 years ago. A bare hilltop which the settlers decided it was time to populate. It starts with, I'll show you this way, it gives you a good idea. You always look for in a hilltop, you always look for a fuel tower or a water tower. That's the first sign of habitation, and then gradually, bit by bit, the caravans move in, and slowly the roads get tarmac, and an idea becomes a reality without any kind of paperwork being done or any kind of consultation with the government. And frankly, as we'll discuss later on, the government seems to prefer it that way. To give you an idea of how Armona came about, let's look down to the valley. Down the valley, that is the settlement of Ofra. Population 3,000, been there since the late 70s. That is the hub. Like Shiloh, where we were before, is the hub. Ofra is the hub of this hilltop post. Now, there are about 106 new hilltop sites, 60 of them built since Ariel Sharon came to power, which suggests perhaps there's a certain urgency on the part of the settlers to get as much ground as they can before the rules change, perhaps before the roadmap starts to be enforced. Let's take another look down to the Valley of Ofra, and you'll see how these settlements, very clearly, how they come about. We see the red roofs of Ofra, I'm hoping now in the shot. As you move towards the east, over the dirt roads, which haven't been tarmac yet because no one's had permission to build them yet, you'll see the caravans. That's the beginning of a new hilltop site. The caravans start, and gradually the tarmac follows, and then the actual building. If you pull back from there, up to the hilltop site where we are now in Armona, you'll see how determined these people are, because the blue and white building you should be able to see now, that's the synagogue. It just serves 25 families, that's all. Now this is John Hyman, formerly from England. John, thanks for talking to us. Is it okay if our cameras take a look inside your caravan? Thanks very much. Now, what's it like? You have a nice house in another settlement, a more established one, and yet you decide to move here to this caravan.
I moved here from ideological reasons. It's not a large population in this area, and this is trying to prevent people, the government, from trying to evacuate people that come and settle Israel, which is our obligation. Because if we're more people here, then we're a larger population, then it's going to be more difficult to tell us we have to leave the land.
You told me earlier on you have a way of describing why you should be here.
Yeah. Well, what I believe is we're a nation that's about 2,000 years in the diaspora, and persecution and expulsion. Countries in Europe and even in the Islamic world, and we survive. And the only place we can really survive and exist is here in Israel. This is our place, this is where we belong. Every nation, it belongs to a land. And I believe the people of Israel belong to this land, and this is the only place we can live.
This is your natural habitat.
Exactly.
John, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Well, as you can see, it's partly a numbers game, and that's the problem for the roadmap, but some of the people we met this morning already give you perhaps a taste of the determination of the individuals who exist and build behind the settlement.
Some form of Palestinian government has been in place for almost 10 years.
Okay, we could turn the lights on again, please? Could someone do that? So you can see that the descendants of Abraham along Isaac's line feel very entitled that at least those settlers who have come to settle in the areas of the West Bank, which were seized and occupied by Israel after the 67 war, to ensure that those lands will not be given up, that they are very determined and committed to the promises that they feel that have been theirs. But Abraham's descendants follow two family lines. In addition to the long-awaited Isaac, there is his older half-brother, Ishmael. And it is through Ishmael that Muhammad later traced the Muslim lineage to Abraham. So I'd like to review the story a bit. You might get out your Bibles. Genesis, the story of Abraham basically begins in Genesis 12. And we see that Genesis 12, that Abraham is given a promise to go from this country from which he's going to be made a great nation. Journeys to Canaan, to Negev, to Egypt, where he passes Sarah off as his sister. In chapter 12, he returns from the Negev back to Shechem. He's given a second promise in verse 14 and goes to Hebron. In chapter 15, the question is raised, why am I still childless? You've given me this promise. And a third promise is given. In chapter 16, since the promise has been given and given and given, it seems like Sarah decides to take things into her own hands. And this is one of the ways that Christians have interpreted what happens here, is that Sarah sort of tries the one-upsmanship and says, okay, this obviously isn't working. Hagar, why don't you take Hagar, and then the child born to you will be our child. And this was within the tradition at the time. So the handmaid of Sarah is given to Abraham. However, when she conceives, Sarah sends her out away. She has a change of mind. And Hagar flees from Sarah. An angel comes to her and tells her to return. And a promise is given then to Hagar that she will, her offspring will be greatly multiplied as well. So Hagar receives a promise from God. And then Hagar bears Ishmael, is back again with Abraham and Sarah. In chapter 17, there is a fourth promise to Abraham. The promise comes, Abraham laughs and suggests, again, you know, we're really, really old, and I've got Ishmael, won't he do as an heir? But the promise is made through Sarah, and Sarah is not cast off as a mother. But it's also given this promise that Abraham's descendants will also come through her. Then in Genesis 18, we have the three visitors who make the announcement again, the fifth time, and Sarah overhears and laughs. And it's a very specific promise this time, the child's going to be born in the spring. Okay, so we're honing in finally. Then we have in chapters 18 and 19, Abraham bargaining with God about Sodom and Gomorrah. In chapter 21, Sarah conceives and Isaac is born. And then we have a second story of Sarah asking Abraham to cast out Hagar and Ishmael. Abraham is given, in his response to this, a promise of nations that will come also from Ishmael through Hagar. And there's a second promise to Hagar in that. And when Hagar and Ishmael are cast out, God opens Hagar's eyes to a well of water in the wilderness, and so intervenes and saves this child, Ishmael. Then in chapter 22, we have the near sacrifice of Isaac, the command to Abraham to sacrifice his beloved son, Isaac. And at the end of that, when his hand is stayed, he's given the sixth promise in verse 17. And then in chapter 23, Sarah dies at Hebron, and Abraham buys a cave for her burial. Chapter 24, Abraham gets Isaac a wife, Rebekah. And then in chapter 25, verses 12 through 18, Isaac and Ishmael come to bury Abraham. And in that section, we have listed Ishmael's 12 sons. There are six or seven promises, depending on how you count them, to Abraham about what's going to happen to him through Isaac and Sarah, through Sarah and her child Isaac. You have four promises, two promises to Hagar directly, and two to Abraham about the descendants that will come from Ishmael. You have quite a fascinating connection here between this promise that to one that becomes a catastrophe for the other, and how God works with that. We have a set of two linoleum prints which are really marvelous. I wish I could have found them before I came. Of one of Sarah and one of Hagar. They're done by a woman, Luba Lukova. And one picture Sarah from about the shoulders up, and she's this lined old face, you know, kind of toothless, smiling, and she has in her hand baby booties. The wonder of in her old age finally receiving the promise. And then you have Hagar, depicted as an African woman, emaciated on a dry landscape. She was Egyptian. And the child about ready to die, a familiar scene for us today with the advent of photography. And so these two, where you have the promise and the joy being catastrophe for the other, is something that in the Israeli-Palestinian situation we are constantly aware of. How this wonderful promise for the people to return, or the promise of this nation of Israel becoming catastrophe for the people who lived there already. I want to go back to particularly the story of Hagar being sent out. And it starts with Sarah. Sarah is, unlike most of the women in the Bible, is very well drawn. We know a lot about her, and therefore we know also a lot about her faults. And she's a very human person. And we can see that in the way that she treats Hagar, either in both of those two stories, which may be the same story told differently, or they may be two stories that it's disturbing to think of it happening twice, but that Hagar would be cast out. These are the way it goes. And I'd like to read the first part of Genesis 22. The child Isaac grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. So she said to Abraham, "Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac." The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you." Now, there's been a terrific amount of trouble begetting this child, as we know, this Isaac. And it seems like neither Sarah nor God are going to let it go too easily. But even though this is a terrifying story of the casting out, it's also a story that has promise. Because listen to what God then tells Abraham. "As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring." But it looks pretty bleak out there in the wilderness, where it's dry and Hagar is alone with her son. So Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water in the skin was gone, she cast the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, "Do not let me look on the death of the child." And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. So she places him under this meager bush, some sort of shelter, and waits and weeps. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar?" What a great question. What troubles you? But the angel continues, "Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him." In other words, don't cast him aside the way Sarah has cast you aside. Don't be afraid to hold on to him. God has not cast you aside. And in fact, God has great plans for you. Then God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water. It's kind of a reversal here of Eve in the garden, I think. You see Eve having her eyes opened and seeing that she was naked and tries to separate herself from God. In this case, you've got the woman already in the wilderness, Eve being cast out later in this story. But Hagar already in the wilderness, and when her eyes are open, she sees a way to life. And the blessing of God and the protection of God. And that's the way the story ends in this section. God was with the boy and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. And then later we get these 12 sons. And how often do we study that genealogy of Ishmael? We know about the 12 sons of Jacob and so on, but the 12 sons of Ishmael, not usually paid too much attention to. Now, there are some very important parallels between the stories of Hagar and Ishmael and Sarah and Isaac. And I'll just briefly point to some of them. The stories are on the same page in many Bibles. I mean, this is kind of amazing, where Abraham is tested, in a way, maybe tested twice. I have wondered if the fact that he had to agree, the fact that he agreed to sacrifice one of his sons, if that somehow, that God wanted to know if he would be also willing to sacrifice this one. I don't know. That's something that occurs to me as a something that might be going on in these two stories. Abraham's tested by God and asked to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac. It's a chilling story. And I don't pretend to understand everything mysterious that's going on there. But I want to point out two things when you compare it to the Hagar-Ishmael story. And that first one is that, could it be that Abraham's willingness to trust God, which is associated with the story of the near sacrifice of Isaac, was first tested most painfully by trusting God's promise to Ishmael and Hagar, even in the face of overwhelming odds. Having trusted God in this, did he somehow need to follow suit in being willing also to sacrifice Isaac? I don't know if that's the way God works. Maybe it was in the case of Abraham, and I pray it never will be in my case or yours. But they are stories about, and powerful ones, about trusting God in circumstances that are way beyond what's normally required. And the second thing that rings true as a parallel is God's provision. God's provision. God acts, intervenes to save both of these children from death, from certain death. In Ishmael's case, it's a mother whose eyes are open to find what's needed. In Isaac's case, it's a father whose eyes are open to find what's needed. In the mother's case, the well of water. In the father's case, the ram who can substitute for Isaac. And in both cases, God provides. God asks for faith beyond faith, but God also provides life where death is certain. I think it would be interesting for us to hear the story that, as it's told in the Quran. Because in the Quran, the story of the near sacrifice of Isaac is told instead of a son of Abraham. Not specified which one, but the tradition has been in Islam that the son was Ishmael and not Isaac. Isaac is certainly a character within the Quran as well, but Ishmael takes on more. And I'd like you just to hear this, because it's a little different. And maybe we don't get a chance to hear the Quran too often. This isn't obviously a translation. We gave him news of a gentle son. And when he reached the age when he could work with him, his father said to him, "My son, I dreamt that I was sacrificing you. Tell me what you think." He replied, "Father, do as you are bidden. God willing, you shall find me steadfast." And when they had both submitted to God, and Abraham had laid down his son prostrate upon his face, we called out to him, saying, "Abraham, you have fulfilled your vision. Thus do we reward the righteous." That was indeed a bitter test. We ransomed his son with a noble sacrifice and bestowed on him the praise of later generations. Peace be on Abraham. Thus do we reward the righteous. He was one of our believing servants. We gave him Isaac, a saintly prophet, and blessed them both. Among their offspring were some who did good works and others who clearly sinned against their souls. rather different. There's not any story about the ram there, but the child is not sacrificed. The parallel of the Jews and the Arabs, and the lines drawn between Isaac and Ishmael, of course, in the long run are kind of nonsense, genetically, you know, ways again to really try to do this. After 4,000 years, the bloodline is hardly pure. And Palestinians really will say that they are descendants of all the ancient peoples of the land, including the Jews that resided there. The Arabs and Jews lived in relative harmony as neighbors for 1,300 years in the Middle East and North Africa. It hasn't been a constant fight between the children of Ishmael and the children of Isaac. It was in Europe that the Jews fared tragically. We need to remember that. It is not written anywhere that the relations of Jews and Arabs are doomed to strife. And we had wonderful examples of this among the Lutheran pastors in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, how after all of these years of difficulty, they were very able to speak without malice, without bitterness about Israelis and to Israelis. And this was remarkable to see. So it is not given. I think one of the things that can help us as we look now at our relations together is to think of these stories in somewhat parallel columns. And we came across this, now I'd like to see this. This wonderful window, which actually is in Prague. I was stunned to find it there on a visit in October, I think it was, this past year. And can you turn out the lights? I'm afraid, of course, this is always the problem, and you can't really see it well. So let me describe what's here.
What we can do is we can leave it on, and people can walk up and look at it more closely, and then we also have a booklet that goes along with the set of slides.
But the main thing that I wanted to show is that it's in the center of this. It's unfocusing somehow.
Because it's as well as it goes.
It's as well as it goes.
Better?
In the center, you have Abraham in a striped coat, receiving the promise of the many descendants. And there's sort of all these people here, okay, that are surrounding him. And God is giving him the promise here of all these descendants. So this whole area here is one of promise that is being given. Then, in two parallel columns, which I don't know, I've never seen ever in any other presentation. You have the story of Isaac and the story of Ishmael, specifically their sacrifice stories. You have, wait a minute, this is backwards.
Mm-hmm.
It's backwards, sorry. It's the other way around.
Okay, let me just...
It probably doesn't really matter for our purposes.
And let me just point out that what's so outrageous about this icon is that this is the only picture in the iconic tradition of God. And you think about that because there's a strict prohibition against picturing God. And there we have this picture of God. And so puzzle it out. Why is this allowed? And think about the incarnation. Now I'll try to...
Okay. This is Ishmael. Okay, you've got Abraham in his striped coat again, and Hagar and the child being sent out. You have the parallel here of Abraham about, I think he might be, I can't tell whether this is the sword or if this is his binding of Isaac. It's hard to tell. But in any case, he has got Isaac in his arms and is prepared to sacrifice him. Here you have the angel in the Ishmael story coming, intervening, you know, visually, completely, you know, that takes up this whole section. And you have the same thing here, then, the angel intervening very clearly. A presentation of things as parallel stories. And then you have Hagar reclining, giving up, and the child over here, and then you have this little bush, and you have her receiving the understanding that there is water and they will not perish. And here you have Abraham in a very similar form to what Hagar is in, and he too is receiving from this intervening angel the news and the keeping of him from that terrible deed. Then what you have below here is another story that has been localized to the Czech history. And it is a story of the saving of the inheritance line of a particular family, the Schwarzenberg family, who gave this window. So in 1721, down here you have a couple that is giving thanks, either giving thanks for the birth of a son, or is being betrothed. It's a little bit unclear to me what's happening. Here you have the family insignia, and here you have a picture of the couple. Again, it's a little hard to tell what's happening, but the description in the book says that they are at giving thanks at a sarcophagus of a saint who intervened to maintain their marriage. It looks, I mean, that may be the case, but in any case, what's happened here is that this story has become a way of patterning what happened in keeping this family's line intact. And the sort of laying of a personal, political kind of history over what has happened in the biblical story is something that we do often and with some fear and trembling. And now in these days, I think when we look at also the Palestinian and Israeli situation, to take the ancient promises to the Jewish people and to lay them on top or to take the current promise, the current situation laid on top of those ancient promises, we must do that with fear and with trembling. So this is what I wanted to show to you tonight, and I hope that some of it starts to make sense as we go through these various ways of looking at that political situation and what we understand from the theological background and what we can understand from other sources.
Like, did you say when the stained glass was created?
This was created in the 1930s.
What church?
It's at St. Vitus Cathedral in Prague, the big cathedral. So, we're out of time, and I meant
to... We have 10 minutes for discussion?
Well, we've got about, I don't know, well, the Vespers is at 7:30, so we can have a little time. You're welcome to be able to leave earlier than that. So, are there questions you have? The video, any of it?
Are you going to be able to, or share with us your thoughts now of the present situation and the recent political changes in the last few months?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
That will come up in the, this is all by way of prologue.
Right. I assume that.
This will come up as in our next session, which will be on Thursday.
Okay.
And we'll be looking at the roadmap. We'll continue with Andrew Wilson, but we'll look at what is the roadmap? What are the goals? What is the measure? Points so that they can determine whether or not performance has been achieved and things like that. We will look at that. This is to really try to indicate sort of the major story that for Palestinians, what was a joy for Jews and for Christians in 1948 was a catastrophe. And to try to understand that and then to read back in a way theologically in the story, since most Palestinians, almost all Palestinians, are Muslims. A very, very small 1.5, 2.5% maybe of Palestinians are Christians. And they play a very critical role, not just now, not just in history, but in the future. If Palestine is going to emerge as a tolerant state, Christians are essential for a variety of reasons, both political and theological reasons as well. So this is to try to look at the theological lineage of Palestinians and Israelis and to understand for Israeli settlers, the ones that Andrew interviewed were really, they weren't the most rabid. There are some that are, the ones that had the guns and were throwing rocks are wouldn't even talk, I'm sure, with the correspondent. And then there are a lot of settlers that are purely economic settlers, that you can get a house for much less in the West Bank than you can in the state of Israel. So we're going to come back to that as we talk about settlements. We wanted to show you that settlers read the promise to Abraham. Though nowhere in the Bible is it mentioned that Abraham is a Jew, but they read that promise as a promise directly to them. And just as Muslims read the story of Ishmael as a promise to the Arabic world. And one of the places that we'll talk about is Hebron, and that's where there is this intense gravity.
That's the home of
Abraham. Yeah, where Abraham purchased the cave as a burial place for Sarah. That there's this intense gravity of the settlers and of the Palestinians, and we'll talk a little bit about that in later sessions.
Any other questions or comments?
When was that Sky News series done, did you say again?
Middle of May.
Of this year?
Uh-huh.
And how far had the roadmap been figured out, or was it just a phrase at that stage?
No, it had already been drafted. It was, but Bush did not want to release it. The roadmap is authored by what's called the Quartet. The United Nations, the United States, Russia, and the European Union. And so it had been authored, it had been formulated. Both Israel and the Palestinian Authority had had informal access to some of the earlier drafts, and Israel had commented quite extensively on the roadmap. Bush didn't want it released until the Palestinians had put in place a prime minister, a kind of alternative power source to Arafat. Bush had made it quite clear that he did not want to deal with Arafat, and certainly the Israelis didn't want to have to deal with him. And so once Mahmoud Abbas, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, was installed in office with a cabinet, then the roadmap was released. And so it was well known what was contained in the roadmap, but at that point, we'll hear more about that on Thursday.
So I'd like to conclude with a prayer that was written at the time of the Iraq War. Prayer for peace with Iraq and the Middle East, and specifically because Abraham in Hebrew is in Arabic, is often called Al-Khalil, the friend of God. And Al-Khalil is the name of Hebron, the place which is the historic site of Abraham's tomb. And Ur and Haran, the cities from which, according to Genesis, Abraham was from, both lie within the territory of modern Iraq. Let us pray. Lord of hope and compassion, friend of Abraham, who called our father in faith to journey to a new future, we remember before you the country of Iraq from which Abraham was summoned, ancient land of the Middle East, realm of the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, birthplace of great nations and of civilization. May we who name ourselves children of Abraham call to mind all the peoples of the Middle East who honor him as father, those who guard and celebrate the Torah, those for whom the word has walked the earth and lived among us, those who follow the prophet who listened for the word in the desert and shaped a community after what he heard. Lord of reconciliation, God of the painful sacrifice, we long for the day when you will provide for all nations of the earth your blessing of peace. But now, when strife and war are at hand, help us to see in each other a family likeness, our inheritance from our one father, Abraham. Keep hatred from the threshold of our hearts, and preserve within us a generous spirit which recognizes, in both foe and friend, a common humanity. This we ask in the name of the one who came to offer us the costly gift of abundant life.